Perimeter, and thanks ITEC for the invitation to talk to you about my work. Okay, so let's get started. So a little warp space is a variant on a Randall-Sundrum warp space. So I will tell you about a particular piece of work we've done on this in collaboration with Christian McDonald, who's at Heidelberg now. I'll explain what a little warp space is and how it's used. And what we want to do is incorporate four-dimensional gravity, and I'll explain why we need to think about that. And when we do that, the degrees of freedom, the graviton and the radion modes, are significantly altered when you include gravity in such a little warp space. So little warp means that the ultraviolet scale is much less than the Planck scale, and so you don't automatically have gravity included at the Planck mass. Newton's constant is not the right size. So after I've explained the degrees of freedom, I'll show you how you can actually stabilize the space using Goldberger Y's and how that's modified from the usual case. And then as a particular example or application, I'll talk about the mini seesaw model and how you can use the little warp space to generate a neutrino hierarchy.
So what is the motivation from the outset of this setup? Because for Randall-Sundrum, the entire point of bringing all the way to the Planck sphere is that you can explain the hierarchy problem.
Yes.
So what is the motivation for doing this?
So on the next slide, I'll go through that. But it's, I mean, a warp metric is to generate a low scale from a high scale in general. And it doesn't have to be the weak scale from the Planck scale. It can be the weak scale from a gut scale, and then on you have more something else.
Right, only that there is something special about the Planck scale.
Yes, it is. It's the fundamental scale, yes. I'll say a few more words in the next slide. Towards the end of the talk, I'll actually go through something slightly unrelated to this, which I've been working on and I think is interesting, about leap point symmetries. Okay, so as Ate asked, what is the motivation of this particular setup? Well, a warp metric allows us to generate a lower scale from a higher scale in a relatively stable way, as Randall and Sundrum showed in 99. And they made a particular model, as you know, which gave you a stable weak scale from the fundamental input parameters that were of order the Planck mass. So that's just schematically what I've drawn here, warping down the Planck scale. So there's, from model building purpose, you can just use this as a tool now to generate some hierarchy between mass scales. And a little warp space is just when you truncate the Randall-Sundrum space, and the ultraviolet scale here is brought down to some much lower scale, and also the bulk curvature scale is now of order M star, of order the UV scale. So this, for example, in the little RS model where you try and solve the little hierarchy problem, why is the Higgs light and we haven't seen any degrees of freedom around that mass? We still have, you know, up to a TeV and there's really not much going on. So there's a little hierarchy problem which you can use this to solve. You can generate other hierarchies. You can use it, as I will show, to generate a neutrino mass scale, small neutrino masses from order one input parameters. And also, maybe you only want to describe things up to the gut scale, and then from then on, there is other physics going on. And also, from the ADS-CFT point of view, it gives you a way of understanding some maybe strongly coupled system with bound states. So there are a few motivations for looking at this. Okay, so now that I've told you we're going to have a low ultraviolet scale, what are we going to do about the Planck mass? So we need to, as an effective theory, describe Newtonian gravity because we know it's there. And so we have to have this small Newton's constant coming in somehow. So the way to do this is to introduce brain-localized scalar curvature terms. So the usual terms that you know are just the bulk curvature here and the cosmological constant, the brain sources here, and the introduction here of the brain localized scalar curvature R constructed from the metric on the actual brain, on the UV and the infrared side. So the sum over I is a sum over the ultraviolet and the infrared brains. Now, for this particular piece of work, we found it easier to work using a manifold with boundaries as opposed to an orbifold, because there were lots of boundary conditions and with the degrees of freedom, the KK degrees of freedom that we had to go through. So just following this work by Karina Licken and Park, we introduced this Gibbons-Hawking term here instead of having an orbifold. And that's necessary with this particular factor relative to these factors here to get the Einstein's equations coming out correctly.
So the second term is... The second 4D term, omega I, and that's
Yes, on the brains. So I've just written it like this. So VI and WI are dimensionless. And the VI is the one you're going to see in subsequent slides. So yeah, that it's just the way I've written the dimensions there.
What is small k?
Small k, sorry, is the bulk curvature scale. So you know, e to the minus 2k in the warping factor. Yeah. So m star is your fundamental Planck fundamental sort of mass scale, and yeah, k is the warp.
You know that this configuration is a solution to the full 5D Einstein equations.
This is a model, and then it gives you 5D Einstein's equations in the usual way.
I mean, you need to make sure that that thing you wrote down and put in the brains is really a solution to the.
I don't have a metric ansatz yet. When I ansatz the Randall syndrome warp metric, then I have to verify that that ansatz is a solution to the Einstein's equations that come from here. These W's can be zero and these V's can be zero, and I can turn off those terms. I can turn off my bulk cosmological constant. And then this is just a theory of gravity. It's just a theory of gravity. And the reason I choose this 4 here is to make sure Einstein's equations do come out when I vary the action correctly, because I'm working on a manifold with boundary points. Normally a manifold in GR has to have, you can't have boundaries. At each point, you have to have an open circle, which is contained within the manifold. But when you have a manifold with boundaries, when you sit on the boundary, an open circle is no longer contained completely within the manifold. And so in order to get the right equations of motion coming out, as in GR, you need to have this Gibbons-Hawking scalar curvature, extrinsic curvature term. So this here is evaluated on the boundary of the manifold. Okay, so pictorially it looks like this. I have a little warping, so the warp factor doesn't vary too much here. This is the bulk curvature, and then these are the brain localized scalar curvature terms. So R computed from the metric confined to the brains here with their respective dimensionless constants here, which just control how much of this I have on the brains. Now, to work out the effective Planck mass, it is quite simple. You just go through and you look at the dimensionally reduced by making an ansatz for the warp metric, integrating out the extra dimension, and having a look at the coefficient in front of the four-dimensional Ricci scalar. And this piece here is the one you might be used to from the or familiar with from normal Randall syndrome. It's the Randall syndrome piece coming from the bulk. And then you have these two extra additional pieces coming from the contributions of the brain localized curvature terms. Okay, so just looking at this formula, we can see that if we wanted to have a large Planck mass given, you know, m star and k of order, say, a TeV or something, and we wanted m Planck to be the correct value, then we'd have to introduce a very large VUV here. VIR is not going to do much because it's warped down, and we'll see later on that actually VIR is constrained to be smaller than 1. But VUV you can make as large as you like, so say order 10 to the 30, and it will give you the right Planck mass. Okay, so that's the answer to sort of the first part of the problem. How do we include the correct scale of gravity in these little warp spaces? So the more interesting thing now is what happens to the particle physics at colliders. The degrees of freedom, the KK modes, the graviton and the radion, what do they look like? How are they modified by the introduction of these terms on the brains? Okay, so just as an additional motivation for including these, or this in particular, this UV term, is that if you want to actually realize Randall syndrome from string theory, then these terms naturally arise. In fact, with large coefficients, they come in naturally. Okay, so...
Can I just ask, how large is this VUV?
So VUV, as I mentioned, with about 10 to the 30, you need in order to get the Planck mass coming from, say, M star being a TeV or so, which is a particular example I'll show you later on.
So, and these are designed to circumvent the hierarchy problem here. It's 10 to 30. Between, like, the VUV and VIR have a hierarchy of 10 to 30.
Exactly, yes. Now, so VIR, you wouldn't naturally make very large because it's going to, I mean, you're explicitly breaking in the ADS-CFT picture, this is not a natural term, but this is a natural term because it's a fundamental operator that can just come from some higher order or some higher energy physics that you've integrated out. But this one here is not natural, really, to put in there. I mean, we did it in the analysis just to see, because it was the same as having this term. But
do you always have some, like, composite strongly attracting picture in
mind? Or? You can, yeah. I mean, towards the end, I have a slide on just a bit of discussion of that. But, yeah, you can always think about this as the... is it's just a way of calculating stuff, but ADS-CFT, I mean, it's really a 4D strongly coupled theory, but I'm just computing things and using a five-dimensional Einstein action.
Oh, is there an intuitive reason why BUV in stringy realization would be more than 10 to 30?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay, so as usual, you vary the degrees of freedom to get the equations of motion. So you have a bulk equation of motion, which is Einstein's equation with a cosmological constant. And then you vary the boundaries. So you have the 4D Ricci scalars there. You have the Gibbons-Hawking term to vary. And then you also have surface terms coming from the bulk variation. Anyway, these all add up and give you this particular boundary equation, which must be evaluated on both boundaries. So in here, everything you've seen, except theta I, which is sort of like the normal. So for the theta UV is -1, just points inwards. Okay, so this is just an equation, and you know, you have to solve it, of course. We like to work in straight gauge, which is just defined by, you have these sort of off-diagonal vector parts of the metric zero. And then in order to look for the degrees of freedom, you just do the usual thing, expand your background metric. You have a background metric and you expand in small perturbations, H, M, N on top of that. Okay, so all of this stuff here is in this paper here, which is what we were basing a formalism on. Okay, so I'll just go through the massive modes first. So these are the massive spin 2 modes. In the perturbations, you have a H mu nu block and then a H55 piece in the corner, which you can always factorize like this in a certain gauge. And then this tensor block here can be written just, you know, it's 10 degrees of freedom can be written out as a transverse traceless plus all these extra pieces here, a vector piece, which is also transverse and two scalars. But then you can get rid of the scalars and the vectors as usual by, well, applying some of the equations of motion as well as choosing a particular gauge that you're allowed to choose. So it just ends up being the transverse traceless part left over, which you do a normal Kaluza-Klein expansion here. So F is the profile of your particular field, the extra dimensional profile, which is the interesting piece. And it has a particular equation of motion, which is actually the normal one in Randall syndrome here. The thing that's changed, the boundary conditions, so you have these terms here. Okay, so you can see that if I make VUV very, very large, then this essentially just forces F, the profile, at the UV brain to be zero. So it sort of just makes you have a Dirichlet boundary condition. Whereas usually, as is on the next slide, usually in Randall syndrome, the boundary conditions for these Fs, these profiles, are Neumann boundary conditions. But the introduction of these brain-localized scalar curvatures make them Dirichlet. That's the main thing going on with the physics here with the degrees of freedom. So this is a approximate formula for what's happening at the UV brain, assuming a large VUV. So it's suppressed like 1 over VUV. So physically, you're just pushing the profiles into the bulk away from the UV brain. Light modes are already localized towards the IR, so they're not changed much. And in fact, So their spectrum, which is the zeros of this this Bessel function here, are this similar, very similar to RS. But the heavier modes, because they were originally have a bit of overlap with the UV brain, are now pushed into the bulk, and their spectrum has changed. Okay, so this is the spin to massive degrees of freedom that I'm talking about here. So for the limit of an infinite VUV term, which is, like I said before, we want a very large VUV term, so this is a good limit to look at. The Planck mass is sent to infinity. The massive KK gravitons are pushed into the bulk, but their normalization, which I haven't shown, but which we computed, their normalization still remains finite. So the actual, the modes themselves still remain in the spectrum, even though M Planck has gone to infinity.
But you're not allowed to zero space.
Any, yes, exactly. So, yes. So in this, so now the zero mode, yep. So that's the massive KK modes. So in addition to that those modes there, we have a massless spin two mode, which is the graviton. And also,
you have the mode.
So, okay, so this, the graviton spin two mode. Yes, so it, this is its profile here for a finite VI. But when for a large UV term, the profile goes like this. So if you send VUV to infinity, the whole profile itself goes to zero, and you've killed off that degree of freedom. And I mean, physically, you've sent M Planck to infinity, so you shouldn't have, you don't have Einstein gravity. So that's exactly what's happening. But for finite VUV, you still have a finite profile, and you just normalize the wave function, so the degree of freedom is still there.
So won't you basically just reproduce all the same coupling in modes as the normal RS with the UV at the Planck scale?
For the graviton, yes, because, well, you need to have universal coupling of all matter to the graviton anyway to have,
right.
So you don't violate.
I mean, basically your choice of VUV is e to the minus 2k times whatever it needs to take it back to the Planck scale.
Yeah.
So wouldn't just bring it back to the RS model throughout?
Not for everything. For the radion, it changes a bit. As I said before, the massive KK modes, their spectrum is changed because of the function that you solve for zeros to find the actual mass eigenvalues is different now. Okay, so that's the spin two modes. Now this is the spin zero modes. So because you've introduced these brains here, and the distance between the brains is a new degree of freedom, a spin zero degree of freedom. So it's going to be massless if you don't stabilize the system. But it's first of all instructive to look at the unstabilized case. So we write our perturbations in this particular form here. So this is consistent with straight gauge. And P1, P2, and P3 are five-dimensional perturbations. They depend on X and Y, so X, mu, and Y. A is just the background. Now, the way that we constructed this was by looking at quantities. So originally, you just write down a naive ansatz, and then you look at how these quantities change under gauge transformations, diffeomorphic transformations. And then you sort of look to construct something that's gauge invariant, or you look to find gauge invariant version of these variables. And that's how we came up with this particular ansatz. It's just an ansatz, but it turns out that this ansatz simplifies the equations of motion considerably. Okay, so the equations of motion are, well, two of them are here. The integration constants from these are zero, so that your modes are localized in X. And then you can solve the first one to find P2 in terms of P1. Here will allow you to find the profile of P1. And then you have one final bulk equation of motion, which just says that P1 is a massless mode, which is what you expect because the radion is unstabilized in this case. The additional variable P3 is actually free in the bulk. It's just some remnant gauge freedom that you have, although its derivative on the boundaries is related to the value of P1. This is just an just some boundary condition that comes. You've enforced straight gauge, so you don't have this function to be completely free in the bulk. It's free in the bulk, but it has to have some particular boundary condition. Okay. So you can solve for the profile of the radion. It comes out as the usual case, just an exponential. And the normalization, so when you put this solution back into the original action that you had, and you dimensionally reduce, but keep second order terms in perturbations here, so I can get this kinetic term coming out. I get this normalization factor here, so I want to make, well, I have n, which I want to make a particular value so that all of this is 1, so I have a canonically normalized kinetic term. And the particular value I choose is just essentially the inverse of that. Okay, and so you can see here that if VIR is greater than 1, then this becomes negative, which you can't have it, then you have a ghost. So that gives a constraint on VIR being small, as I said in the start. But there's no constraint on the VUV term. So you can have VUV as large as you like, and this, the normalization is still positive and well-behaved. Okay, so that's the radion unstabilized. How does it couple to matter? Well, through the trace of the stress energy tensor and some scale lambda r, and this is what lambda r looks like when you have these boundary terms here. Assuming a large VUV, it's approximately takes this form here. So the coupling it to the IR is pretty much the same as in the Reynolds-Sundrum case. It just couples as the warp down value of the fundamental scale. But localized field, for ultraviolet localized fields, because the introduction of VUV pushes these fields, degrees of freedom, away from the brain, anything localized on the UV brain is highly, the coupling is highly suppressed to the radion. So that's the main change here. Okay, so but for bulk fields, so if you have, say, bulk fermions, their masses are obtained generally from an IR localized Higgs, and fermion masses produced on the IR brain and then couple to the radion on the IR, and like I said before, that's same as in the IR, as in the original Reynolds-Sundrum case. Okay, so far I've told you about the little warp space and the having a large UV term, the spin 2 and spin 0 degrees of freedom, and now we'll detail the way to stabilize the system. Okay, so let's follow Goldberger and Wise and do the usual thing by introducing a bulk scalar. And everything goes as expected, it's just the details are a lot more technical. So the complete action, you just have this extra bulk scalar with a bulk potential. You have brain-localized kinetic terms for the scalar in general with some coefficient Ti that you can set to 0 if you don't want them there. And then they have also some brain-localized potentials. Okay, so you have to vary the action to get the equations of motion. These are... So in black is what I showed previously, and then in blue is just a scalar field. It's nothing special. Okay, so vary that action there, and you get these equations of motion. The Einstein's equations come from varying the metric, the boundary terms here. This first line is what I showed you many slides ago, but this you have this additional piece here coming from the scalar field. And then you also have to vary the scalar field itself to find its bulk and boundary equations of motion, which, this is the usual one, and then you just find something going on here. So this is all in a particular straight gauge, which is a general gauge you can make. So we want to now solve these equations of motion for the radion. So we need to solve basically in three steps, zeroth order, first order, second order. We solve for the background, and then we solve for the first order perturbations to work out the profile of the radion, and then we put all that back in to second order in the action to work out what the effective action is to get the normalization and to work out what the mass of the radion is. So it's quite an involved process, but at the end, the point is to work out what the mass of the radion is in this particular setup and how it changes when you have these UV and IR localized brain kinetic terms. Okay, so the first step is quite straightforward. You just look at the zeroth order equations and you get the solution is just A, which is like the warp factor, and the background phi, which is your Goldberger-Wise stabilization field. You don't solve for them explicitly. They're just implicitly defined in terms of differential equations. Then you use that to work out what the perturbations are. So you look at the first order equations of motion and boundary equations, substituting the background equations that you found, and then you get this. Essentially, so you can eliminate the P1 and P2. You can eliminate P2 and P3 is free in the bulk. P4 are the perturbations of the scalar field, and one of the equations of motion relates that to P1 itself. So P1 is the thing that you look at, and this is its sort of Schrodinger-like equation, which we can recast into Schrodinger equation with a suitable change of variables. And the eigenvalues of this equation here give you the mass of the radion. You also have this very complicated boundary condition, which you can simplify by considering stiff brain potentials, as people normally do. But this is the full thing if you need it. The solutions, just you do separation of variables with the usual case with a scalar field here with the mass m. And it's just a simple Schrodinger equation to find the spectrum, the profiles, and the mass eigenvalues. Okay, so take the solutions that we've found and substitute it into the original five-dimensional action. Dimensionally reduce, as in integrate out the fifth dimension, and you have the action, the four-dimensional action is just a sum of zeroth, first, and second order pieces, where the order is the order of the perturbation. So L0 vanishes, and it must, because we have a 4D Minkowski ansatz. You can't have any extra zeroth order energy there. The first order piece is just proportional to some box of psi or box of P3. So psi was the four-dimensional radion degree of freedom. And under a four-dimensional integral, these things vanish, because it's not psi box psi, it's just box psi. So that's just a total derivative. Okay, so as expected, the zeroth and first order terms all cancel, although non-trivially. And the second order piece is the piece that's left. You have to do a lot of integration by parts and make sure you collect all the terms in the correct way, because there are many terms coming from many different pieces, boundaries, and bulk. But in the end, you get a canonically normalized scalar, four-dimensional scalar psi with mass m, where m was just a solution to that Schrodinger equation I showed, and gives you the mass of the radion. And the normalization factor here, n, is this particular expression here. Nothing particularly profound in that. It's just there. You can compute it and see what, you just use it to renormalize the scalar field here. But the mass eigenvalues don't depend on what n is. Okay. So this coming to the interesting part, let's have a look at working out maybe what the mass value could be. So in order to have a calculational example, we take the Randall syndrome background and add a small perturbation onto that. So you modify it in a small way, and this is the Goldberger-Wise stabilization field. This is a particular profile, and L is a small parameter, so working to order L squared. And the length of the extra dimension is given by this formula here, where U and phi UV and phi IR, which are the values of phi on the UV and IR brains, so their ratio, the logarithm of their ratio, sets the length of the extra dimension. This is just the usual Goldberger-Wise mechanism. Okay, so with this particular background or choice of background, so this satisfies the zeroth order equations. You could choose something else, but we've just chosen this.
Why did you choose this particular perturbation?
Why did we choose this particular form?
Yeah.
This was done in this paper by Chaki et al. That when they were computing the radion mass, they found it convenient. I mean, this particular solution for the Goldberger-Wise field solves the bulk equations of motion exactly to all orders in L. So it's a good thing to choose. But then if you wanted to go back and solve for A completely, I don't think you can get it analytically. So you just say, well, assume this is a small L and we can see what we can do just to second order in L. Just to get something coming out analytically, tractably. But in general, you can just numerically solve the equation, the zeroth order equations of motion to get the background and then work out the mass eigenvalues numerically. I mean, there's nothing stopping you doing that. This is just I mean, you don't want the Goldberg-Weiss field to react too much. You know, you want it to be a small perturbation just to stabilize. You don't want it to completely change your warp factor. You still want to have generally a warp factor looking like it normally does. Okay, so the solution for the profile for the Radeon, which is this small P1 here, is the usual case plus some small perturbation. I haven't given you the function, the form of F here, but it just has some particular form. What's more important is the mass eigenvalue. So this is the first KK state, so the actual Radeon itself. There are a higher tower above that, but this is the one that's interesting. It's the first one that you would see at the LHC if such a thing existed. And you can see that the introduction of these terms changes the mass values.
So you're saying P is what you call the Radeon. What is phi?
Phi is the Goldberger-Weiss background scalar stabilizing the system, and the Radeon is the perturbations of phi, but mixed in with perturbations of the gravity. You know, so there's scalar parts of gravity and the scalar parts of phi, which are mixing, giving you the degree of freedom, are called the Radeon. But phi itself is the background field. So there's two small things here. I've added a small phi, like I've taken RS, I've stabilized it to, you know, second order in L using this phi, and then I'm looking at perturbations of that, which I call the Radeon. This is the standard case Okay, so this mass here is not very sensitive to the VUV. So you can put in a large UV brain term, and it doesn't change much the Radeon mass. So the stabilization, it works. Just as it would have in the RS case. And then to first order, the Radeon couples to matter in the same way as in the non-stabilized case, which is what I went through before. So you don't have to go, well, the calculation doesn't get that much more complicated. But so let's have a look at this Radeon mass in a little bit more detail. So what have I chosen here? I've chosen U to be the ratio U, which is just a parameter in the Goldberger-Weiss potential, and K is the bulk curvature scale. I've chosen this ratio here to be small, and then I can approximate my mass like this. You can see that the mass is just, so the warp down bulk scale, which is what it usually is, and then it's suppressed by this small L and this. Well, KL is the size of the extra dimension, which in RS is like 37. And so 1 over KL is quite a small value. And the Radeon mass is actually quite low, which is generally can be a problem in Randall syndrome models. That this is like the electroweak scale, and it's suppressed by quite a large number. OK, so what can you do with these extra terms here? So you can bring VIR close to 1 to make M larger, if you like. But then, I mean, you're introducing some operator deep in the conformal bulk, but that you can do that, and it does increase the Radeon mass. But you can also see that if I have a fixed infrared scale, say the electroweak scale, and I have a smaller extra dimension, then my mass can be larger than in the RS case. So the RS case would give, say, you know, 1/40th of this electroweak scale is a Radeon mass, but if I have a little warp space, then my Radeon can be much heavier, which can be phenomenologically interesting. Okay, so just a few comments on ADS-CFT. So these theories, you can think of them as extra-dimensional theories, but you can also think of them as dual to some strongly coupled theory, which they're trying to help you calculate the bound states, and the KK modes are dual to certain bound states of whatever spin. So in ADS-CFT, the conformal symmetry is broken explicitly in the ultraviolet and spontaneously in the infrared. Ultraviolet operators considered as fundamental operators, and the infrared ones as composite ones, or infrared degrees of freedom that are localized in the infrared are considered as composite objects in the dual picture. Okay, so if we don't have this ultraviolet brain term that I've advocated introducing, then the Planck mass in the normal Randall syndrome case is induced entirely by whatever the dynamics of the cutoff of this conformal field theory are. But there's no reason that we can't introduce some bare contributions to the Planck mass, like you just introduce bare terms in, you introduce terms in an effective theory when they're allowed by the symmetries. We're allowed to just put in some ultraviolet localized operator, some operator here. So from an effective field theory point of view, it's allowed by the symmetries. And so this is why it works. It doesn't screw things up. The normalization of your Kaluza-Klein modes are still okay. You've just introduced this fundamental operator.
That's a bit of an overstatement, right? Because in the effective field theory point of view, you would say it's an order one number, it would be order one.
True.
Or the third.
That's true.
So I mean, if I'm at a Planck scale, I would say, we just write down the usual kinetic terms, and the beautiful thing about Randall syndrome is that you flow down to the IR and you find M Planck going down to like the weak. I think it's a little bit of an overstatement to say that effective field theory allows you to write those things.
Okay, I would agree. It allows you to write the term in there,
right?
And
allowing you to write the 30.
10 to the 30. True. Okay. Yes. So. What? Oh yeah. So okay. So that's the main piece of work there, discussing the degrees of freedom in these little warp spaces with a large UV term. A particular application was a mini seesaw model. So I'll just briefly mention a few things here. So it was warping the TEV scale down to the GEV scale, so UV to IR. The standard model was put on the UV brain, and there were some bulk fermions which ended up being warped down via this warping mechanism. Their coupling to the ultraviolet localized standard model was highly suppressed, and then you had not only the suppression from the warping, but also a seesaw mechanism coming into play, and you got light neutrino masses. And in this particular model, one of the interesting things was mu to e gamma, which has just recently been updated in the limits by the MEG collaboration, which this particular value here, which is this solid line. And the model predicted these particular dotted and dashed curves for bulk mass parameter C, which you see up in here, of order one. You go pushing into the interesting region here. So this is just a particular example of a little warp space. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about that. Now I have till 11, do I? Or I mean, you said.
At 11, there's another seminar.
Okay.
A few more minutes.
A few more minutes. Okay. So I wanted to change gears completely and talk about something else. So this is still model building, which I consider myself generally a model builder, a particle physicist. And what I wanted to talk about now is something I've been working on recently, which is to do with finding symmetries in actions, or in actions, Lagrangians that you write down. So usually you take a set of symmetries and you write down all the terms that you're allowed to have. But you can actually go the other way. You can write down terms arbitrarily and then work out what symmetries you're allowed to have, or what symmetries are allowed by this particular terms that you wrote down. Okay, so the Lie-Point symmetry method, which is what I'm going to describe, is the way of finding, it tells you how to find these so-called determining equations, kind of like a counterpart of the Euler-Lagrange equations. The Euler-Lagrange equations you solve for the fields, but the determining equations, their solutions are the symmetries of the system. Okay, so this method it's a mathematical method, but it has good application to physics, and it's quite general and quite powerful. It gives you an exhaustive systematic search of all symmetries. So if it doesn't find an answer, it means the symmetry is not there. Even if they're written in a spontaneously broken way, it still finds them. No matter how you've written your action, it will still find particular symmetry if it's there. And it will find also interesting parameter relationships that yield enhanced symmetry. So if masses are similar, you might have a rotation, a U1 symmetry, and it will tell you this. And I'll go through a quick example for that. The algorithm is guaranteed to terminate in a and so on. And it's applicable not to a Lagrangian, but to any set of differential equations like a Schrodinger equation or hydrodynamic equations or any particular differential equation that you might have. But I'm going to describe the application to an action. So if you take an action and you vary the coordinates by a little bit, eta mu, and the fields by a little bit, chi I, these variations can depend in it in an arbitrary way and don't have to be linear functions. They can be arbitrary functions. The action changes by a bit, delta s. And by doing this, you can get many, many interesting, well, fundamental equations. You can solve for the fields to get the usual Euler-Lagrange equations. You can construct a divergence, and that gives you Noether's theorem. But there's one third thing that you can actually do, and is actually solve for the infinitesimals themselves. So normally in the Euler-Lagrange equations, you say, oh, the infinitesimals are arbitrary functions, and then they vanish on the boundaries, and what are the Euler-Lagrange equations that minimize the action? But if you instead say, okay, given values for the fields, what are the solutions for the infinitesimals themselves? So what are the symmetries of the system? So you get this so-called master determining equation, which is an equation to solve for the infinitesimals, and it tells you the continuous symmetries of the system. Okay, so as a quick example, so we have this Lagrangian here with two fields, just phi 1 and phi 2, which have masses m1 and m2, so extremely simple. And I'm going to look for the internal symmetries of the system. I'm going to ignore the coordinate symmetries just for the sake of simplicity. So in that case, this so-called determining equation looks like this. You just plug in the Lagrangian to here, and you just differentiate away, as you do with Euler-Lagrange equations. And you get this determining equation, which you need to solve for chi 1 and chi 2, which are the infinitesimal transformations of phi 1 and phi 2. You look at this, and it's kind of like a polynomial in derivatives of phi, and you have to extract independent coefficients and set them to 0. And you get these four independent equations. Now, we have to solve those equations. I've just written at the top here again. The general solutions look like this. So chi 1 and chi 2 have this particular forms. And I'll just tell you that alpha 1 and alpha 2 correspond to shift symmetries of the original phi 1 and phi 2. And beta corresponds to a rotation between the two fields. So what it's saying is that of this system, the only symmetries you can have are shift symmetries and internal rotation. And that's because I've ignored coordinates, so I didn't get Lorentz symmetry. But it will get that if you include coordinates. And it will also get conformal symmetries in that case too. So the determining equation that you have to solve now, given these solutions here, so you plug this chi 1 and chi 2 into this final determining equation, and it turns into this algebraic equation. And it has these three parameters, which are essentially the generators of the three independent Lie groups. And you need to satisfy this for this equation here. And you see that it picks out the particular case where m1 is equal to m2. So if m1 is equal to m2, I'm allowed to have beta non-zero, meaning that if my particles have the same mass, they have an internal u1 symmetry. But if m1 is not equal to m2, then the only solution is to have beta 0, so the u1 symmetry is not there. So here you get the equations are telling you, with this particular choice of parameters, you have this particular symmetry. And similarly, if I have massless particles, I can have a shift symmetry. If I don't have massless particles, I can't have a shift symmetry. And that's just, yeah, that's obvious to see.
Should there be a square on the phis?
On the phis? No, because m1, phi, chi, and chi is just alpha. This is like a polynomial in phi. So this is the second order piece.
Because beta have alpha.
Yeah, alpha and beta have different units. Yeah.
But then why did I have an equation separate for each one?
Because I only have one determining equation here. And
but phi 2 and phi 1 are independent.
Well, no, because they can transform amongst themselves as a symmetry. I mean, yeah.
I guess I don't understand what you call, how do you determine, should it sound to be independent or not?
Independent.
So in the previous slide?
Yes. Oh, I see. Well, how I extracted these four from here. Oh. Yeah, so, okay. You have to think of this as like a polynomial in derivatives of phi 1, derivative of phi 1, right? So this is an independent term. But this is DMEFI1, DMEFI2, DMEFI2, DMEFI1. So these two terms
so
combine.
I thought I understand that, but if that's the case, then why Phi1 and Phi2 are not independent?
Because Chi1 depends on Phi1 and Phi2, but not the derivatives of Phi1 and Phi2. So it's a polynomial in derivatives of Phi, but not in the value of Phi. The value of Phi and the derivative of Phi are considered as independent quantities in this in what I'm doing here. Yeah, sorry, I don't have enough time to explain it. Maybe afterwards we can for sure talk about it. I just want to push through. But let me just trust me for the moment that from here you can extract independent equations, which you then solve. But this equation here, well, you can also construct. You just take derivatives of this with respect to phi, and this is an independent equation, so is this, and so is that. Just take derivatives. And in a similar vein, take derivatives with respect to the derivatives of phi functionally, and you get these equations coming out. Okay, but the point of this is that the model parameter, the parameters, the masses will dictate the symmetries, or vice versa. You can say, I want a rotation symmetry, therefore I must have the same mass. Okay, so this was a simple example just to show you the technique and what's going on. So a more complicated example, I can have n scalar fields written down here. I've got a gauge, a U1 gauge field here, generic couplings that respect Lorentz symmetry between the gauge field and the scalars here and here, and then an arbitrary potential. Okay, so this is just the theory of n scalars coupled to one gauge field, or it's one vector. It's not really a gauge field yet because there's no gauge symmetry. It's a vector. So this is my Lagrangian, and I want to know what are all the symmetries of this thing. I just plug it into this determining equation, and you get a lot of stuff coming out, but eventually you can get to the end. And the end is these are the infinitesimals. So this is the coordinate sector, this is the scalar sector, and this is the vector sector. Okay, so I've sort of tried to color code. A, B, C, and D are the special conformal group. So A is translations, B is Lorentz symmetry, C is scalings, and D is the special conformal transformation. And you can see how that comes out in the whole thing here. So I didn't have to know anything about Poincaré symmetry for this. I mean, I just wrote down this action here, and I worked out that these were the symmetries of it. I mean, in hindsight, I wrote down Lorentz invariant terms. You don't have to write down Lorentz invariant terms. And then it will tell you, well, if your kinetic term has this structure, you will have Lorentz invariants. The other symmetries here are internal. So this is a shift symmetry, and that's a rotation symmetry, and this is the gauge symmetry. And you see that we now have local rotations, because the rotation can depend on x. We also have local shifts, like a gauge shift, which is like the Stackelberg mechanism. And then you have the gauge parameter here, lambda. You also have extra determining equations, which constrain j, k, and v. But this is true for all potentials that you can think of. This is the most general set of symmetries. And then this is restricted by solving the additional determining equations. So one thing you can do is say, okay, we want to have a massive U1, so we want to have m squared a squared in our Lagrangian, but we also want to have a gauge symmetry, as in a continuous local U1. How can we do that? And so I want lambda to be arbitrary, because that's my gauge symmetry, and then I want my potential to have this particular mass term in it. And then I derive the allowed form of the rest of the parts in the Lagrangian and any relationships between parameters that allow me to have this. If I include one scalar field, then I can derive the Stackelberg mechanism. And the J here is the mass of the scalar of the gauge field. If I put two in, then it tells me the Higgs mechanism is what I need. And it will give me a spontaneously broken potential and all that stuff. Okay, so this is the mechanism. It's quite powerful. If the symmetries are spontaneously broken, it still finds them. No matter how you write them, your symmetries, it will find them. In view of the time, I can't explain that in full, but talk to me later if you want. So applications, you can find maybe there are hidden or accidental symmetries in a model that you want to find. Maybe you want to look for some new crazy symmetries like the Galilean symmetry that you wouldn't have naively thought of before. You can find approximate symmetries. I'm looking at the extension to discrete symmetries because so far it just does continuous symmetries. And then you could perhaps look for family symmetries in the standard model, see what sort of things you can get there. Now we know that if we take the standard model and we add X gauge bosons, and we can get up to SU5 symmetry coming out. So what this, if you took the standard model and you just kept adding vector fields, eventually you would get to a point where this Lee point symmetry method would say, okay, if you equate the mass of, you know, of the particles in the right way, then you're going to get an SU5 symmetry coming out. So it will tell you that the SU5 is there. And if you keep adding more degrees of freedom, enough fermions to fill a 16 of SO10 and so on, and enough gauge degrees of freedom there, it will tell you that SO10 is a symmetry of the standard model, and you can just keep going. But in this way, you can systematically find all the possible extensions of the standard model, the symmetries, and any relationships amongst parameters, for example, you know, your car was in the Higgs or whatever you have. Okay, I mean, this is an ambitious program. I haven't done any of this, but I'm just, this is a particular application that you can think about.
Is that also extendable to gradient algebras?
It's extensible to supersymmetry, yes. You have to have anti-commuting quantities. You can do general relativity in it. It's not confined to scalars. You can do spinners. You just have to write them out in their real components. Yeah, you can do all continuous symmetries, including supersymmetry.
But it's not important that all the generators only satisfy commutative relations.
They may have to satisfy. Yeah, maybe you would have to extend the formalism from the very beginning to incorporate that. Maybe we can talk about this later on. So let me just move. So this is my final slide, conclusions. So for the first most part of the talk, I was telling you about little warp spaces, large UV localized kinetic terms to give you a correct Planck scale in these phenomenological models, how the KK spectrum was modified, the Radeon de Gridham, how it came out, and how you could make it heavier, and how a smaller little warp space gave you a heavier Radeon. I showed an example as a mini seesaw, and then just at the end then I told you about Lee point symmetries and finding symmetries. Okay, thanks for your attention.